KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell, live. It's The Treatment, that is, two interviews recorded before a live audience. On April 29th, I was joined at the Free Film Festival at the Detroit Institute of Arts by my guest, Emmy and Tony Award winner and Oscar nominee Lawrence Fishburne. His career exploded by working with Francis Coppola on Apocalypse Now when Fishburne was just a teenager. And his other collaborators include Kenya Barris, Spike Lee, John Singleton on his first film, and of course, Pee Wee Herman. And here we go. You are one of the few people I know of who survived and came out sane starting off as a child actor.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
I think because I had really great people around me, like Apocalypse Now, second movie, 14 years old. But people like, you know, my mom was with me. People like Martin Sheen and his wife, Janet, were parenting me. You know, Francis Coppola and his wife, Eleanor, were parenting me. Marlon Brando was parenting me. Scott Glenn, who was also in the film. These people treated me like the adolescent that I was, you know. And my dad also was, he was called over at one point when I was kind of getting, you know, smelling myself a little bit. My mom called my dad, and my dad came to the Philippines from New York to rein me in a little bit, make sure I didn't do anything life-threatening.
Yeah, I think, because we were about the same age, I remember seeing you as a kid on One Life to Live.
Right. 10 years old, 11, something like that.
Yeah. Well, you got to work with Ellen.
Ellen Holly and Al Freeman Jr.
Who were, I mean, talk about mentors. What was it like to have those two people in your life?
Well, it was great. I mean, Al was always going, you know, concentrate. And Ellen, you know, she was just very sweet and dear and, I had a guy in my life named Maurice Watson who used to take me to work, bring me back. And again, I was working in the theater. I was working in black theater in New York with people like Mary Alice, who just passed away recently, and Graham Brown. And there was a director, his name was Irving Vincent.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
You know Irving?
Yes.
So he's Vin's dad.
No.
He's Vin Diesel's dad.
Okay.
So he directed me in like the first two plays I did in New York. And these were all very serious, like they were very serious about the whole theater thing, you know, representing black life in the American theater in an authentic, you know, way. At 10, Mary Alice pulled me aside because I was running around goofing off. And she was like, I know you're 10 years old, but when you're here with us, you're one of us and we're here to work. And it made me cry, but you know, it put me on notice that what we were doing was important.
There, and we've talked about this before, but, I think this mentorship, and you had so many people, our mutual friend Roscoe Lee Brown.
Yes.
Always people who treated you as a peer, and you responded to that with curiosity.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Francis always said to me, you know, I would say, you know, I was crazy or something like that. He was like, no, you weren't crazy. You just hung out with the older people. And the thing was, I liked the older people. I respected them. I looked up to them. And I valued their wisdom and I valued their attention, their validation, their encouragement. So Roscoe was really, you know, he was the king of that for me. But also Mr. Poitier and Mr. Belafonte, who just passed away. Miss, you know, Cicely. Everybody, you know. I mean, Marlon, you know. Anytime I met an older actor whose work I admired, I always, you know, treated them with the most reverence just because I wanted to be good at it. I wanted to get better.
What do you remember about your first conversation with Francis Coppola? What was that?
It wasn't really a conversation. It was the interview in New York, walked into the office. It was Fred Roos, the producer, and Francis. And Francis was sitting in one of those big rattan chairs, like, you know, the one Huey Newton is in that famous poster. He was sitting in one of those. Yeah, Fred kept asking me questions, and I kept answering them. And, you know, the one that everybody sort of talks about is when he says, so you're how old? And I'm like, oh, I'm 14. I'm 16. And he goes, so you're what in high school? I'm a junior in high school. But, of course, they didn't believe me. I mean, they knew I was lying. So this young woman walked in, put something on the desk, got ready to walk out, and Francis spoke. It was the first time he'd spoke. I'd been in the room for 15 minutes, and he said to her, excuse me, do you think this kid could be 18? And whoever she was, she looked at me and she went, yeah, I guess so. And I think that's really how I got the part.
Really?
Certainly had something to do with it.
Because so much of you, for what you do as an actor, is about playing characters who are either mentors or who are really free. I mean, we look at Apocalypse or King of New York,
Or
even Cowboy Curtis, certain these guys who just own, who are living specifically in the moment.
Right. The mentor thing came later. It was really, you know, the dark mentor, light mentor thing really came with Furious.
Well, yeah, Boys in the Hood, because that's also working with a first-time director who probably needed a mentor too, didn't he?
Yeah, and I, you know, I gave him what I could give him in terms of, like, what I had learned working with Francis in terms of improvisation and working with actors in that way, which is the same thing I gave to Spike, you know, when I worked with him on School Days.
It's interesting, too, because so often the movies about college life, everybody's making fun of everybody, and you made sure that this is somebody who's treated everybody the way you were talking about being treated. He treated everybody as an equal. That's, for me, the first time I thought, okay, this is you're playing a grown-up and somebody who's who's listened to wisdom and hasn't discarded it. And I thought it's an interesting choice for somebody who's not taking himself seriously, but understands the world. You know, there's a fine line between that.
Yes, there is. But again, you know, Art Evans is in that movie. Ossie Davis is in that movie.
Sam Jackson.
Ellen Holly is in that movie. Giancarlo Esposito, myself. But it's those elders, Ellen, Ossie, the fact that they came to support Spike meant everything.
What did that feel like? Because in 1988, the weekend that movie came out, the other two black films were Action Jackson and Shoot to Kill. So it's like, it's black awareness in Hollywood. No more that year, but there were those three that weekend.
Sure. That weekend?
That weekend.
Wow. Well, we knew we were doing something that hadn't been done because originally School Days was not a musical. It was not a musical. It was about homecoming weekend and the culminating event is a rape where the guys going over rape one of the girls. That was the event. It was much more of a drama. And I think he got a lot of pushback from Morehouse. Like they weren't going to condone a story that was about that. So he went, reworked it, and then added these musical elements, which I think is quite genius now.
Again, I just thought, well, this felt like to me the beginning of this rise you had, and from then you can sort of tag off to Furious, and then go to The Matrix, and then to Aquila and the Bee. I mean, then King of New York, and in that interim too, there's also Ike, who's somebody who's trying to be free. And can't get out of his own way, but trying to be free. But I mean, I just, that if somebody can do those, play those two poles, those two 180s, because those are really, I think of as being really hard things to do.
Right.
Which is harder to do, the characters who are just out there and living in the moment, or the ones who are more composed and thinking about the world around them?
I don't think of any of it as being hard. I think of it all as being fun. Like, because I love what I do. And part of the fun for me is being able to go 180. The fun part comes when, like, okay, I did this. Now I'm going to go do that. You know what I mean? So it's about, because I have range. And not everybody has range. So for me, it was always about trying to use my range and to find ways in which to do that. So for me, for a long time, people would say, what is the favorite stuff that you've done? And for me, it was like Jimmy Jump, Othello. Like, you can't get any more different.
just before school days, there's Cowboy Curtis.
There's Cowboy Curtis.
Yeah. Who's somebody who's living in the moment and is completely free in that way.
Yeah, and I had no idea what I was doing. Like, I didn't even know it was comedy when I went and auditioned for
What do you mean you didn't know it was a comedy?
I didn't know it was comedy when I went and auditioned for it. I showed up, like, serious as a heart attack, looking like Yul Brynner's chocolate little brother. Seriously. I showed up in this gray cowboy outfit. I was, like, all, like, ready to, like, be in The Magnificent Seven. And I read for Paul and John, and they looked at each other, and they went, lighter? And I was like, oh, you mean like comedy? They were like, yeah. So I was like, oh, okay, cool. Let me get a wig. I had no hair. I was like clean shaven.
Oh, is that why you have
that? Yeah.
I thought that in my own mind that Cowboy Curtis invented the Jerry curl back in the 1800s or something.
Well, when I went out west to live, that's what brothers were wearing. They were rocking Jerry curls. Western culture is a real thing, and Black Western culture is a very real thing.
He's somebody who's completely free in his skin. I just thought that's... It was such an honest portrayal, because so often in that kind of thing, especially if somebody thinks it's a kid show, there's a wink to the audience.
Yeah.
And you never did any of that.
No, because, I mean, I really just followed Pee-wee's lead. The first time I saw Pee-wee...
You see the stage show that you
saw? I saw the stage show at the Groundling Theater.
That show was crazy.
It was crazy. He threw lollipops at people. I didn't get it. But I got the audition through a friend, and I went and I followed him, and I followed the set design. The playhouse itself was a character.
Yeah, designed by Gary Panter.
Yeah, I mean, it was extraordinary. It was like being on, well, what I imagined being in the Batman television series in the 60s was like for me. It was like this opportunity to just be totally childlike. And that way it would work, you know.
Again, you often play characters too, and I've never had a chance to actually talk to you about this before, so I'm glad to do it here. Characters with a lot of pride in the way they look. I mean, that's part of the Cowboy Curtis. It's definitely part of Jimmy Jump.
Yeah, Jimmy Jump. Yeah, sure. Ike, obviously.
Yeah, and I think also Furious, too.
Furious and certainly Ike.
Who's wearing a shirt and tie in his home.
Yeah, exactly. But that's Poitier. You know, for me, I can honestly say that's Poitier's influence. Yeah, you never saw Sidney in a movie where he wasn't clean.
Except for those movies he directed, but...
Yes, but even in those movies where he's a working-class guy who doesn't have a lot of money, there's a dignity to him.
Oh, absolutely. But, I mean, that choice for me for Furious, again, this is about these guys who not only are sort of thoughtful about the way they are, but understand the way they're being perceived as Black men.
That's right. That's so important.
So this is who you're going to see. And that, in fact... It's so often a part of the way you play characters. I mean, I think of it as Morpheus.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, that's Sidney. That's definitely Sidney, and perhaps some of the directive that I got from my parents.
Let's face it, you're not going to toot your own horn in this way. But this idea of making sure that there's some aspect of representation that these characters all understand about themselves.
Right.
I mean, even again with Jimmy Jump, I mean, the way those outfits are put together, you can tell he takes a long time to put that hat on his head.
Yeah,
that
man.
It takes a minute. He's looking at himself to make sure that he's going to be seen the way he wants to be
seen.
He's
got to be right. And again, those were my choices. Like the costume designer did not want me to wear the coat that I had. There's that coat in the beginning with the cards on it that says High Roller. You know, they smudged all of that out with shoe black because it was popping too much. And I was like, all right, no problem. It's okay. For me, he's the first hip-hop gangster on screen.
He is.
And he's the first.
It's interesting because also there's this generational thing between him and Chris Walken's character.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Totally generational thing. But it was intentional. Because the part was written for a white actor, too, you know.
Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, it was written for this actor named James Russo. So Jimmy Jump was supposed to be this Italian kid who worked for Frank White, and he was the one that was recruiting all the brothers to work for him. And it's based on Joey Gallo's story. And Jimmy Russo was in Canada. He was doing We're No Angels with De Niro, Sean Penn. My manager got that intelligence, I went to Abel Ferrara, the director, and said, listen, you got to let me audition for Jimmy Jump. He's like, I got Jimmy Russo. I can't. I was like, no, man, you got to let me do the thing. I want to come in. I want to show you. I got this idea for the character. He was like, okay. So I went and I got the jumpsuit and, you know, I got the Cazals and the fronts. And I walked in his jump in his loft and I just told him stories for like 2 hours in character. And he was like, oh, okay, I see what you're talking about now. Gave me the part. So it was because I had met this kid named Just Ice, who was a young rapper. He was on the come up then. I don't know how many records he made, but just a couple. But that's what he called himself. He called himself the hip-hop gangster. And I was like, that hasn't been in the movies yet. Yeah. Say, we got to do something about that.
It's interesting, too. Can you talk to me about that walk? Because he's walking a 45-degree. He's always leaning forward like he's sniffing something out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's how cats were doing it, man. In the 70s, in the late 70s and the 80s, that's how they were rolling.
After a break, more of the treatment with a live audience and Lawrence Fishburne. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell, and more of Lawrence Fishburne and a live audience recorded at the Detroit Institute of Arts.
You have played a number of characters drawn from real life. We can go back to Ike Turner, and these are between Ike Turner and Thurgood, for example. These are two people who people think they know just because there's a superficial history of them. Sure. And it's important to, I mean, to remind the world that basically the first rock and roll song hit the charts is Rocket 88.
Rocket 88.
And who is that?
Turner. Yeah. And he was the first guy to put a woman out front.
Because so many people think of that person in two-dimensional terms. And it's incumbent on you to sort of say, he's a tragic figure, but he wasn't without ambition. And he wasn't somebody who clearly was damaged by the way he came up as well.
Yeah, I mean, he had a lot of trauma. He had a lot of trauma. And he was, you know, he worked through it in some terrible ways, but he also worked through it in a really brilliant way. You know, I mean, we wouldn't have that music. We wouldn't have Tina's music without him. And it's timeless, the stuff they made.
Was that a daunting character to take on just because of the perception of him?
Yeah, he was the hardest one for me because, you know, I had a history of some domestic violence in my life that I had to go get help for, you know? And I was afraid that I would revert to some of that behavior. So I was in counseling while I was doing the film and I was talking to a psychiatrist about all that stuff just to like ground myself. You know, I had some anger issues, you know, so I worked on those things and made sure that I didn't revert. During the filming, there were quite a few times when we were doing one scene or another where I had to be abusive with Angela and all that stuff. And people would like really stay away from me. People like, they wouldn't look at me. They'd be like, oh, shit. You know, but he was probably one of the most difficult things I've had to do.
Your character in Cotton Club is also one of these first mentor figures too. Somebody who's actually a grown up as well.
Yeah,
kind of grown about beyond his years even.
Yeah, Francis said it was my first grown up part, and I didn't know it. But you know, 6 months before I got cast, he was having story meetings with Gregory Hines, the late Gregory Hines. Gregory was like, well, who's going to play Bumpy? And Francis was like, Fishburne's going to play Bumpy. Like, he knew months before that I was going to play this part. I had no idea. I walked into the audition and I was like, they were like, so what are you going to sing for us today? Yeah, but Bumpy's really beautiful, beautiful character, really complex and, not a nice guy.
So what was it like to meet Augusta Wilson?
Man, it was great. I had auditioned for Lloyd Richards about 4 or 5 times before I got the role in Two Trains Running. And I wound up getting the part and I wound up doing the play for like 3 years. And August and Lloyd really were mentoring me. I was with Roscoe and August and Lloyd, and they were all mentoring me in their own way. August largely silently. Lloyd, man of very few words, very few words. But I understood his history, right? I knew that Lloyd Richards directed Poitier and Diana Sands on Broadway in Raisin in the Sun in 59. And then, you know, I won the Tony and I ran into August. Thank you. I ran into August and he said, "You're holding out on me." And I was like, "What?" He was like, "You should be writing." And he gave me this pad that he wrote something on. "Here I give you the pages of a hymnal anticipating the words of the witness," or something like that, that he wrote in this pad for me. And then, you know, I wrote my first play like 2 years later.
You're saying something that actually fits in with something that somebody told me that Matt Damon said that he heard from Jack Nicholson.
Oh, wow.
Any actor who's had a long career is a writer.
Wow.
At some point, you're authoring what it is you're doing.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and we started that with Apocalypse because, again, we had a script, but we never used it. Everything we did on Apocalypse Now is every scene is improv'd. Every scene. There may be elements that were scripted that are in, like, informational stuff, like expositional stuff, like, where are we going? You know, like, we're going 35 clicks up the river or whatever, but everything else is all, we're all making it up.
Because I'm wondering, as we talk about this, we're talking about mentor characters. Certainly in the last couple of decades, two of your biggest characters, between the Bowery King and John Wick and Morpheus, mm-hmm. have been characters who I wonder what you wrote in your journal about those guys.
You know, I haven't been journaling about those guys. You know, because sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. And with Morpheus, what's so interesting with me and him is he's the character that most people love the most. Like, he's the most popular one. A lot of people need me to be that guy, and I'm not that guy at all. I mean, there is a part of me that is that guy, but there's this other larger part of me that's not that guy at all. You know, and is not interested in being that guy. And then the Bowery King is more like me than you would think.
In what way? I can't. As I move my chair away from you, in what way is the Bowery King more like you?
Because he's free. Because he's free. And I'm much more free than I am reserved in my real life.
I know. That's why I was talking about these characters who are free
yeah.
and in the moment versus yeah. these characters who have to think two or three steps ahead.
Yeah.
And I wonder
yeah.
if there was a kind of an affinity you had just because I think of you as being both those guys, but much more these guys who are just... Yeah. Trying to take everything in as it's happening.
Yeah, I'm much more about that, about being free and about being in the moment, because I'm curious and I'm an artist and I want to try something different. I don't want to always do the same thing. Now, of course, the longer you do a thing, the more familiar people become with your thing and the more sort of predictable you're going to be anyway. You know what I mean? Because it's like you're going to run out of tricks at some point, unless... You can grow, unless you can grow, right? Unless you can change. But that requires effort, you know? Change requires real effort.
One of the topics we always get back to at one point or another
yeah.
is comics. And
yes.
you are doing for Disney an adaptation of an old Marvel comic,
right.
Devil Dinosaur.
Devil Dinosaur, Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur on Disney and Disney Plus. Lunella Lafayette, 13-year-old African-American girl on the Lower East Side with her family, smartest person in the Marvel Universe, and her sidekick, Devil Dinosaur, who is a 50-foot red T-Rex. And I voiced a character called the Beyonder, who's a strange sort of Marvel character.
So the other side of eternity.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, we produced this show. We have two seasons in the can. The last episode of the first season just aired like 3 or 4 weeks ago. We have two new seasons coming. And it's been a blessing, man. It's been so great. You know, she's the first female black teenage superhero ever.
But we've been talking about these characters who are these polls. And last question, I have to ask you about your character in Black-ish, who's supposed to be a mentor, but also lives way too free, too.
We're really free.
Yes.
It's great.
So he's both of these things.
He's both things. I hadn't really thought about it, but you're right. He's absolutely free because he's so old that he can say whatever, like, you know, you get to be a certain age, you say whatever the fuck you want.
But in flashbacks, too, as he's wearing Cowboy Curtis's wig, he's as free
he's
30
as free.
Years ago
I know.
As he was
yes.
in contemporary times.
Yes, yes. And it's, you know, it's based on Kenya Barris's dad. For me, it was first Anthony Anderson, being able to play with Anthony, because Anthony is a great comic actor. He's a great comic actor. He's also a very good dramatic actor, too. But his comic, he's got timing. You know what I mean? He's got the size. And Tracy's also comedically brilliant. Just so smart. And so I just felt like they were not going to let me fail.
But I feel it's for me, it's the Venn diagram. It's the intersection of these two poles. Somebody who's supposed to be a mentor figure.
Right.
And in his way, every once in a while is against
yes.
his better instincts sometimes, but still trying to be
right
what he thinks a mentor is supposed to be.
Right.
But
right.
also this guy who cannot help but live in the moment. I mean, to me, it felt like almost this perfect intersection of so many things that you've done.
Yeah, it is. It is in many ways. I mean, the grandpa chair is really, it was very comfortable to be able to like, to play those poles with this guy. But of course, comedy allows you to do a lot more than drama does. You have certain restrictions with a drama. And certainly with a comedy like Black-ish and what we were attempting to do and the things we were trying to talk about, because also we were doing that intergenerational thing. And that's what gave us the license to, that's why Pops is able to like be as free as he needs to be. The generation that I'm representing there is a generation that had different concerns right in front of them. And not the same kind of resources that Anthony and Tracy's characters had. Their generation, they're affluent. They're professional people. Pops and Ruby, Pops is like a guy who was like hustling whatever kind of job he could get, if he was going to get a job. And sometimes he was operating outside of the law. So there's a certain kind of freedom in that.
Anyway, on that, I will thank Lawrence Fishburne for coming on tonight and giving us his time. Thank you all for coming out. Thank you to WDET and to the Detroit Free Press
Thank
Film
you guys.
Festival. Thank you all so much. And most importantly, a big thank you to Mr. Lawrence Fishburne.
Lawrence Fishburne, whose career ranges from The Matrix to John Wick, from the Free Film Festival in Detroit in April. It's The Treatment. Past interviews are, of course, at kcrw.com/thetreatment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment, live. Well, recorded live, here at KCRW this time, with director and artist Garrett Bradley. She recently exhibited her work at MoCA and her documentary Time went at Sundance and was nominated for an Oscar. Join us for the conversation, which is part of Freeze Los Angeles. Talk to me about working with Arthur Jaffa. First of all, that piece is kind of amazing. Not kind of,
Starting it off with Bootsy Collins, I want to get ahead of myself, but talk about working with Arthur on that piece, A Negro, A Limo.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was summer of 2021. Linda Good Bryant, you know, was working with Thomas Lacks. They were organizing the show Jam, Changing Spaces Jam, which stands for Just Above Midtown, which was a gallery artist-run space that she had organized in New York City, and was really kind of, it was a place where artists could come together and actually have disagreements and contradict one another and have really, you know, strong debate around history, around practice, around what it means to be a Black artist, what it means to make quote-unquote Black art, and all the different ways in which somebody might be coming to that from, right? And so the question that Linda was really thinking about was, is it possible to take that intention and take that space that she had created and bring it to an institution like the Museum of Modern Art? Can those two things actually coexist with one another? I'll say that, you know, Linda is somebody who, she's a filmmaker, she's a person who brings people together, she's a, you know, food advocate. She has so many different iterations even of herself, right? One thing she's amazing at is bringing people together. And AJ is somebody who, like, we're very different, we're from very different generations, and I think that maybe we would have found each other had it not been for Linda, but I actually think that Linda is the one who kind of universally was like, I'm seeing something that maybe he and I, it would have taken us a long time, you know, to get to in a certain kind of way. And the first part of the conversation was like, well, what is Black art? And I think neither one of us were really interested in answering that. And neither was Linda, actually. It was, and that was the beauty of the whole thing, right? It was like, we don't actually have to do that.
But it's the question that gets asked
But it's
anyway.
The question that gets asked over and over and over again, you know, even in abstraction, trying to sort of assert a certain sort of history or perspective or context onto something that might be completely non-figurative. So that was the question. And it basically was like a year of us just talking on Zoom and like hanging out. And then we kind of decided AJ was going to do his thing. I was going to do my thing. And I was like, well, look, let's make sure that the sound is the same, because otherwise it's going to be crazy. So both of us work a lot with sound, but he was working with sound.
In textural ways, you work with sound.
Exactly. And so he would send me little snippets of things. I would send him little snippets of things. And what the work ended up being is this sort of conversation, I think, that is in so many ways trying to both address and evade this central question around the history of Black art and what it means to be a Black artist today.
There's a question that's come up in a couple of those pieces that you sent me that we hear on camera. How do I look to you coming from Black women? Mm. I want you to talk about that, because having that question in two different pieces, what that means.
Well, yeah, this question of like, how do I see myself is oftentimes so tied to how we think others see us. So the work I think that you're referring to is AKA.
And Alone.
And Alone, yeah. Alone talks about how she sees herself in a very different. So the prompt for both of those actually comes from slightly different places, but it is systemic. It does come fundamentally from the same place, as you're saying. But so in my effort to think about this, I realized, you know, actually I've got more questions than I do answers around what this would mean. You know, my process has always been, frankly, and I think it comes from making films in high school kind of by myself, because it was, and this is a very
and
sort of...
And asking questions in those films.
And asking questions, you know, because, and this is gendered, but like, I have to say a lot of the boys when I was in high school were really good at like coming together and making things together. And a lot of the girls were like very independent. Like I wasn't going to get a bunch of my girlfriends to like make a film. Like that was not happening. You know, everyone was like doing their own thing. So I found a way to make things that I could do this on my own. And I think that sort of became a path that I've continued to move down, which is to really want to get a better understanding of how other people think and feel, and then to take all of those thoughts and put them into this space that exists so outside of any kind of binary, because it isn't one person, you know, it creates multitudes of something. And so I went to family members and friends and some people I'd met on social media, and I asked them, basically, you know, I found these mother-daughter couples who self-identified as being in Black households with multiple skin tones. And we got down to these sort of basic questions around How does your skin tone and the way in which you self-identify affect your love life, affect the way in which you move through the world, affect your movement in the workforce? And so being under one roof, there's a multitude of experiences.
I mean, I love the way you shoot skin. Mm. I mean, because it's almost as if the camera's caressing that skin. Mm. And there's such a, I hate to use the word embrace, but an embrace of these women in AKA. Mm. I just found that to be so fundamentally powerful. We talked about textual. We talked about this a lot in a handful of the two times we've talked now. And that's why I brought up Arthur, too, because he also does that same kind of thing. You look at Daughters in the Dust. Yeah. You can feel the skin in that.
Yeah.
And what all those different skin tones mean and the way the black skin takes the light, which you're so conscious of as a filmmaker.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's funny because that film I made in 2019 and, you know, I was making another project called America, which I'd started in 2014. I finished that 2019. And so I was working on other projects, obviously, while I was making America, right? Alone, which is my first short film that I did with the New York Times op docs, that was in black and white because I was making America and I really actually couldn't see in color. Like, I just could not even, you know, formally, I couldn't imagine it being anything else. And it's not just about black and white and color. It's also, there's what gradations of color. You know, just because we have color as an option, I don't think that it needs to be a standard. I know that its commercial viability is what's made it a standard, but in truth, it's an option. And you don't even need to have a deep reason to make something black and white, in my opinion. But with AKA, you know, Lindsay Bowler, one of the women in the film, she kept asking her mother, "Are you color struck?" And that was actually the phrase that gave me, I think, the permission to think outside for the first time of black and white in a while.
There's also something that's about the origin of film in that, you know?
Yeah.
Going back to the beginning of the film. And to me, it evokes craft and understanding the possibilities of the medium. And it's this thing that, for me, also evokes a lot of black art, which is about craft, which is about hands being on things. Mm-hmm. And I feel your hands on these films. You know, I feel the touch. Mm. Even though they're often about things that are abstractions, they're not abstract in emotional terms.
Right. This isn't to diminish it in any kind of way, but I wonder if it's also just because most of us have to have our hands wrapped around every element of it. I mean, when you decide that you're going to make a film no matter what, you're not going to wait for anybody to support you in making that film, you find a way to learn everything, you know? And I think that part of the blessing in that is when you're in a space where you can be more collaborative and you can bring more people in and really learn from other people's expertise, you've found your fingerprint, you know, and you can choose to jump from that or not. I mean, for me, I became an editor because I needed to. And I think that a lot of my films are made in the editorial process. And Making Time was the first film where I'd ever worked with an editor before, Gabe Rhodes. And it was so difficult because, and it was amazing. I learned so much from him. But I remember I could sort of was so used to knowing how to shape it in a very specific way. It's actually the closest that you ever get, I think, to touching your film. So the editorial process, and then I would say working with people on set, obviously, but the editing is it's the most physical part of it. And it's the most kind of connected that you can be to it. And I was able to find my shape in the process of having to learn how to do that. But I also realized that I had really hit a glass ceiling and I was making an assumption that there were certain things that we would understand emotionally just through images alone. And Gabe really helped me understand story, story and ideas together. You know, I think ideas was something I just always put everything into and assumed everything else would work out, you know? And that's still okay, actually. But for that film, we needed more.
I want to, again, talk a little bit more about Alone and Time, just because the size of voices in both those pieces and how much of it, in both these cases, of these women finding ways to tell their own stories and create a narrative in real time to explain their lives to themselves.
I think that I was able to figure out an approach for time because I had made America. And America was my first attempt at really exploring archive. you know, in 2014, I read there was an article in the newspaper that the Museum of Modern Art had found what they thought to be the very first feature-length film with an all-Black cast and integrated production team that was starring Burt Williams. And this was, you know, just a few years after Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896, which was also the same year the modern-day projector was invented. So technology, for the first time, was bringing people together in a room where they could all watch something. And society was also separating, right, at the same time. So it was very significant that this was an integrated production, an effort that was happening. And Burt was wearing blackface, but I found there was real cinematic innovation that I noticed in it. And I thought that also it was very clear as a director, as a producer, that he had real authority over what was happening and that he was a character, not a representation of a race. And that was clear because of everyone that was around him, right, who really did feel like individuals, which is very rare to see in 1913 in a Black context. There's a huge plethora of films that are missing during this time period, 70% of them, right? So I liked this idea of thinking about making a project that was sort of building off of an assumption that this one film that existed was representing a plethora of something that was equally as progressive. So America is basically kind of a visual chronology starting in 1915, going through 1923. And in some instances, they're celebrating something that's happened in Black history, but I'm also making the case that that's obviously American history. In some instances, there's a way of inserting ourselves into a space that we're completely missing from, like the Boy Scouts of America, which were established by Woodrow Wilson in 1916. I had started making it when Obama was in office. And by the time I was finished with it, Trump had become president. And so I had to really think about also how to structure this and basically work with Burt, who was not here physically on Earth. But so this idea of like, how do I protect what I know to be true about that material in the 2000s, in this current moment with Trump in office? I had to find a way to force something that appeared really fixed to be flexible. And I had to find ways to get around the sort of inherent challenge of linearity in making films.
You were talking before we got started, and we actually talked about this idea of what it's been like to do this kind of stuff over the past 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And our first conversation was by Zoom.
Yeah.
And we weren't even seeing each other by Zoom. It was just audio Zoom. And so I had all these questions in my head about the way you worked, because you've been so busy and you made a documentary about a public figure during all this time. And what's that been like for you to do that?
Yeah. So around that same time, 2020, I was filming with Naomi Osaka, and we had started that in 2019, and we finished it in 2021. I think. So it was a very tumultuous time for her personally, but also in the world. And it was my first time making something with a person who I'd not met before. I mean, minus Burt Williams, who I also hadn't met here in the physical realm.
I'm hoping, you
know.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, it was really important to me going into that project that I didn't go in with a preconceived notion of what the show was going to be. And then also because her being so young, I wasn't interested in making anything that would feel overtly definitive of who she is. Like, this is Naomi Osaka. We're all in transition. When you're young, you're especially in transition. 1 year to the next can feel very drastic. So that was something that was in the back of my mind. And I think one of the really exciting challenges about making that was also when you're working with someone who has cameras around them all the time and lots of people around them all the time, we had to find a way to make a distinction between who we were and who the other cameras were, both on a practical sense, like, you know, after a game, all the camera guys are on one side of the room and I'd be like, can we be over there? And they'd be like, why do you want to be over there? And be like, because we need to see those cameras and we need to see her, right? Because the other thing about tennis is that it's a total mental sport. It's one of the only sports where when you get on the court, you can't ask for help. It is 100%, it's not even about your physical ability to a certain extent, it's about your brain.
The one thing I was going to say, I connect it to time, but also in rewatching to get ready for this, yeah. I felt that question, how do I seem to you, echoing through it in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I wouldn't say Naomi's introvert in any kind of way. She's really vigilant and very, very aware. And I felt like in some ways the only way to explore what was going on with her on the inside with a camera was to show what was around her. And so I think that central question was also being asked, certainly, even from the perspective of the press. What was her relationship to the press, and how can we be with her? Well, I think the best way for us to be with her is to also look at the press, not to be one of them.
There are a handful of film artists who think through the camera.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to impose. Mm. And you're one of those people.
Mean. Yeah. I do think through the camera. I think I try to think a lot before too. You know what I mean? Like, I try to think, like, why am I making this? And I'm saying that because particularly in a documentary context, some people can do this where they just are like, this is a really interesting subject, situation. Let's just start filming everything that happens.
Every other documentary filmmaker I talk to is doing that. This situation is great. Let's just get in there and get it. And yeah. Then we'll make it in the editing room.
Yeah, I don't work that way. Because I need an anchor. I need some kind of thing that I'm coming back to that's helping me, that's informing every single choice that I'm making, not just for myself, not because I'm going to forget it, but also because I think that then there's a level of transparency with who you're making the films with. That's very clear and translatable to anybody who's on the other side of the camera. So trying to make a case for why you should be in the back of a car while, you know, you're making love to your husband. Well, why do you want to be there? You need to have an answer for that. And you also need it to really make sense on a deep human level that's beyond actually the film, but that is about the intention of why we are even making this.
Let's thank the incredible Garrett Bradley for being here tonight. And thank you to KCRW
and
Freeze and LA Freeze. Thank you. And thank you guys for coming. Thank you all
thank
so
you.
Much.
Artist and director Garrett Bradley recorded at KCRW February of this year. It was part of Freeze Los Angeles. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treat. And it's Alex Borstein, Emmy-winning actor for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and star and writer of Corsets and Clown Suits, a comedy music special, also on Amazon. Her Treat, a musician who has provided balance and ballast.
Hello there. This is Alex Borstein, and this is The Treat. I was going to talk about, it's a whole album that came out in 2017 by an artist called Gordy. And the album's called Reservoir. Drag it from the inside like we're young again. Tear up what they hoped was always in their heads. You know, it's one of those things that music hits you at a certain time and it just kind of becomes a part of you. It starts running through your veins. And I spent a lot of time writing to this album, and in particular this song called Long Way. And it really helped inspire a script that I wrote, a feature that I'm currently trying to get off the ground. You want now, I have such a long, long way to go. That was a huge inspiration and kind of like what I just played over. I'm a creature of habit. I play things over and over and over. We became quote unquote friends during the lockdown. I don't know how. I think I tagged something and mentioned I liked her, and she's like, oh my God. I said, if you ever need a backup dancer or something silly. And she's like, anytime. And then she had a new album come out and she asked me to make a video in my own apartment in Barcelona. And so my little piece is part of her music video for a song called Unready. Oh, the ground underneath my feet was cold. I wasn't looking for you. I love her work and was so lucky then to get to like sit down with her in New York at some point and tell her. I don't know if she believed me, but... Music to me is, it's I can't write without it. It's like breathing and walking. And this was coursing through my veins and kind of came out through the computer. And hopefully you'll get to see on the screen what it inspired. When my film is finally done, I do want her music to be sprinkled throughout it because it's got to be. It's such a part of it.
Actor Alex Borstein, star of Corsets and Clown Suits and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, both on Amazon, with The Treat. You can listen to past treats, including Tony-nominated actress Sharon D. Clarke on music that inspires her at kcrw.com/thetreat. The Treat features notable figures from television, music, film, and sports who share intimate stories about the cultural influences that have sparked their creativity, inspired their craft, and have shaped the path of their lives. The show was produced and edited this week by Rebecca Mooney. She did a lot of work. Today's show was mixed by Katie Gilchrist. We had help this week from Anna Buss and Laura Kondarajan. And thanks this week to my hometown, the folks at WDET and the Free Film Festival. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.